We continue with the history of Israel, part 7, the 1940s, tonight entitled Devastation and Renewal. As always, we're sponsored by Becky and Avi Katz, Le'ili Nishmas, Yona Ben Rav Aryeh Leib, Pinishmas, Otsur B'Tzor Chaim. So there's a handout tonight that only you merit receiving, because you come out and don't rely on the CDs. And take it with you. You should know that when I gave a seminar for college youth in our shul a few years ago, I let them keep this as well. It's a little pamphlet put out by David Horowitz. You may have heard of him. He's a big conservative writer today, son of two communist Jewish parents. Wrote a very interesting pamphlet that goes through the whole history with the sedate title of Why Israel is the Victim and the Arabs Are the Indefensible Aggressors in the Middle East. He gets right to the point. Sometimes you could judge something by its cover, too. There's no decade, so we're referring to this basically for the maps, but you can keep it with you. There's no decade that's more difficult to compress into 1 hour than the 1940s. Up there. In the back. The 40s, the events of the 40s shape us until today. We're still reeling from the Holocaust. We're still dealing with the consequences of the establishment of a Jewish state. Too much? You want to lower it? Try. You know, I'll lower this. This should be all right. It should be all right. In summary, the Holocaust was the inevitable culmination of exile, and 1948 found the start of the Third Jewish Commonwealth. That's a synopsis of the 40s. But in fact, the summary is misleading, because the exile is not over, and the existence of the State of Israel is not really guaranteed, and it's not secure. It's a very controversial decade for many reasons, some which we'll discuss tonight. I mean, the debates that rage in our world today revolve around the interpretation of these events. So, for example, you look at Iran today, what is Iran doing but revising the narrative of the 40s, denying the Holocaust and denying Israel's right to exist? So their state policy is essentially to rewrite the events of the 1940s some 6 days later. There are many factors and events in the 1940s that are unpleasant to deal with, aside from the Holocaust. There was the approach of the Zionist movement to the Nazis, to the Jews of Europe, internal rivalries between Jews, fighting hostilities, Jew on Jew in the land of Israel, during the war, after the war, the very foundations of the state, the creation of the Arab and the Jewish refugee problems after 1948, and especially the two competing ad hayom irreconcilable narratives that exist, what later, after the Six-Day War, became two competing nationalisms, the Arab nationalism and the Jewish nationalism. Arab nationalism, in terms of a state, did not really exist until after the Six-Day War. As we mentioned a few times already, until the late 1960s, their focus was essentially to thwart the existence of a Jewish state. I want to start with just a brief analysis of the Arab role in the Holocaust, because one of the arguments that we always hear from the Arabs is that they're punished for horrors that were committed by the Europeans. And it's a gross untruth. Now, fair to say that a lot of this is blamed on Haj Amin al-Husseini, the Grand Mufti of Yerushalayim, who spent World War II in Berlin. But that was only because he was deported by the British in May 1939 for anti-British activities, and Britain controlled the Middle East. So certainly he advised and he encouraged Hitler to extend the Holocaust to Israel, among other things. He interfered with rescue attempts of Jews. No doubt all that is true, but he wasn't the major figure in the Holocaust, and we shouldn't think that he was. If you look at the book, Lucy Davidowitz's classic, The War Against the Jews, I don't even think he's mentioned in the book. So he was a minor figure that's only important for polemical purposes. But nonetheless, truth be told, the Arabs are primarily responsible for the Holocaust, not the indirect victims. it's because of the Arabs that Jews were prohibited from immigrating into the land of Israel and building the Jewish national home throughout the 1920s and 1930s. If the gates of Israel were locked, it was because of the Arabs, and knowingly because of the Arabs. And granted, the British are at fault too, but the Arab hands are stained with Jewish blood during the Holocaust because they sealed shut the only haven that we had on earth, the land of Israel. So without the Arabs, the Holocaust never would have occurred. So if one thinks to say that the Arabs are suffering because of what European Christians did to European Jews, it's not true. Arabs are suffering because of their own decisions, as they always have. Now, the Jewish role is much more complex, and the Holocaust is a very sensitive subject, and we have to tread very carefully, and hindsight is always 20/20, and we fall into the position of if only they had known then, what we know now, etc. There's another classic work that I commend to you, if only because it's comprehensive, not that I agree with every conclusion. It's a book called The Seventh Million by Tom Segev. It's translated into English. The Seventh Million deals with how Israel dealt with the Holocaust, both before, during, and after, really until the last few years. And he says, by way of summary, that the Zionists dealt with the Jews of Europe in what he calls, I quote, a less than compassionate manner. And it's somewhat of an understatement. The fact is, the refugees to Zion were not always welcome. And the Zionist movement did not make any grandiose or excessive efforts to save the Jews of Europe en masse. There were targeted rescue attempts, but not. There was never a massive movement to try to save the Jews of Europe. Ben-Gurion said in 1938, and granted, you know, people say things and they're given to hyperbole, and you know, you wake up 20 years later, or 10 years later, or now with YouTube, 45 minutes later, and the whole world knows about it. But he said in 1938, if I thought that it was possible to save all the children in Germany, by transporting them to England, but only half of them by transporting them to Palestine, I would choose the second. Because we face not only the reckoning of those children, but the historical reckoning of the Jewish people. What that tells us in a nutshell is that the Holocaust was always perceived through one prism by the Zionist movement. And that is not how can we save Jews, but what will be the effect on the Zionist movement. In other words, what will push forward greater the potential establishment of the Jewish state. So Ben-Gurion said after Kristallnacht that Zionism is in danger because the masses of Jews who would be the corpus of the Jewish state, they're now in danger of extinction. They'll lose potential refugees. So again, to say Zionism is in danger means he is analyzing the conflict in a different way than someone who is only interested in the saving of Jews. And by the same token, throughout the 30s, and even during the war, only refugees of a certain type were allowed to use the British entry permits. Remember, the White Paper limited Jewish immigration to 75,000 over 5 years, 15,000 a year. And Jabotinsky already claimed in 1939 that his followers were being denied permits. He said, I quote, the land of Israel exists today only for a select class, and those chosen are young people whose color is red, meaning they're socialists. Anyone else is not invited. In fact, anyone else is rejected. Now, Begin and his followers would assert bitterly for decades that millions of Jews could have been saved, but for the prejudices of the Zionists. Now, in fairness, no one could anticipate that, what would happen. People, even those who spoke about it, like Jabotinsky, I don't think they even had a inkling of the sophistication of the Nazi machinery of death and how the Holocaust would be carried out. But, and also it's fair to say that you could always rewrite history and say, if only I would have made that decision, then everything would have been different. But there is some truth to what he's saying, and certainly the bitterness is real. because the bitterness, we'll see, came up in a number of incidents in the late 40s and the 1950s as well, especially the Kastner trial, where the Zionist movement was put on trial for its inactivity during the Holocaust. Now, in fact, Ben-Gurion openly opposed illegal immigration for most in the 30s and 40s, not only because it was illegal, but because he couldn't then control who would come. And that was a major interest of the Zionists. In fact, the quotas served the purpose of Ben-Gurion, who was the chairman of the Zionist movement, and the British, and the Arabs. Also, sad to say, the Zionists in the 1930s derided the refugees from Hitler's Europe as what they called Hitler Zionists. You know, they came over on the Mayflower, but the ones who came, not because they were chalutzim, but because they had nowhere else to go in the world, they were looked down upon, and they were criticized, much like the later immigrants were, the Sardin, the Russians, the Ethiopians, etc. During the 1930s, the Zionists always negotiated with the Nazis. Remember the Havara Agreement of Arlozorov we mentioned last week? But it's not surprising. The Nazis had a diplomatic mission in Yerushalayim on Rehov HaNeviim, which flew the swastika until the war broke out in 1939. Israel being under control of the British, they had to close down their mission. So the swastika flew in Yerushalayim, except when the Beitarniks would tear it down. That was an ongoing tug of war. They would tear it down and sneak in, and the Nazis put another one up the next day. Israel suffered also during the war. It's not well known, but Israel was not spared from the effects of the fighting. Italy, of all nations, bombed Tel Aviv soon after the war broke out, September 1939, and 107 Jews were killed. And there were constant bombings in Israel. During the North Africa campaign, especially 1942-43, the Germans regularly bombed Israel, and they had plans to invade Israel. Now, Lucy Davidowitz surmises that if a Jewish state had existed, there would not have been a Holocaust. In fact, that's a cliche that we bandy about now for six decades. The fact is, it's not entirely clear. No one really knows. It's nice to say. But you could make a counter-argument as well, that if indeed a Jewish state had existed, that would have become a priority for the Nazis. So instead of invading Russia in June 1941, they might have invaded an easier British target, which was the land of Israel, and killed the Jews that were there. So no one really knows. Again, the easiest thing is to rewrite the past. As it was, the fighting carried over to the Middle East as well. Remember that the Middle East was divided between a French protectorate, Lebanon and Syria, and the British protectorate, Iraq and Arabia, and the land of Israel. Now, the Jewish Agency already in September 3rd, 1939, right after war was declared, announced that they would support the British, and they said that, and I quote, "At this fateful moment, the Jewish community has a threefold concern, the protection of the Jewish homeland, the welfare of the Jewish people, and the victory of the British Empire." So the white paper was a grave blow to us. But nonetheless, we'll, just as heretofore, we shall defend to the utmost our ability the rights of the Jewish people in its national home. Our opposition, however, was never directed against Great Britain or the British Empire. The war, which has now been forced upon Great Britain by Nazi Germany, is our war. And all the assistance that we shall be able and permitted to give to the British Army and to the British people, we shall render wholeheartedly, very artfully phrased, whatever assistance they're able and permitted to give. Because in fact, they were able to do a lot more than they were permitted to do. The British prohibited, at the start of the war, the formation of separate Jewish fighting forces, fearing that its effect on the land of Israel would be a negative one. But in fact, more than 12,000 Jews signed to fight alongside the British in the land of Israel, in France and Lebanon, which again, being a British protectorate, once right after France was conquered, or better said, right after they rolled over for the Nazis, and Vichy France, the collaborationist government was established, so the sovereignty of Vichy France applied as well to France and Lebanon. So the Nazis had bases and airfields in France and Lebanon during the war. So fighting took place there. Fighting took place in Iraq, which was a British protectorate which German forces had attacked. In fact, in Iraq, David Raziel, who was the head of the Irgun, was killed. The Irgun always suspected that he was actually killed by the British, but nonetheless, he died there. Fighting with the British in Syria on a reconnaissance mission, Moshe Dayan lost his left eye. Reconnaissance, looking through binoculars, and a bullet went into his left eye. In May of 1941, the Haganah, which was anticipating an invasion by Germany from Egypt and North Africa, formed what they called Plugot Machatz, assault companies, or strike companies, better known by its acronym Palmach, Plugot Machatz, strike companies commanded by Yitzhak Sadeh, and their purpose was to prepare for battle with the Nazis. It was a volunteer group basically charged with special operations, waging a guerrilla war against Germany, reconnaissance and sabotage in Syria and Lebanon, and then, of course, they became involved in illegal immigration. One of their techniques, which proved very helpful, is that they would train more platoon leaders than were necessary, so that if they had to expand their units, they would have commanders already properly trained who could then take over those units. They reported ostensibly to the commander of the Haganah, but they were somewhat autonomous as well. Irony of ironies, they were funded originally by the British, and of course had the unintended consequence of preparing a Jewish army for the War of Independence. August 1942, there's fierce fighting raging in North Africa. So, I mean, just so everyone is on the same page, the Nazis ran through Western Europe, Poland, and then Western Europe in late 1939 and early 1940, having conquered France and then Southern Europe as well. As the Battle of Britain was raging in 40-41, it ran afoul. They weren't as successful as they thought. Hitler turned his attention to Russia, June 22, 1941, vitiating his non-aggression pact with the Soviets. And at the same time, in 1942, they attacked North Africa as well. August 1942, they're making tremendous progress, heading from Tunisia eastward. There's fierce fighting. They're advancing through Egypt, heading towards the land of Israel, and Israel then was in a war footing. Blackouts, air raid drills, rationing, plans made to evacuate. It was a certain point where the Jewish agency started shredding its vital documents because they thought they'd have to leave. It's at that time, August 1942, just a brief vignette, Rav Yosef Shlomo Kahaneman, the Panovich Arov, was a recent refugee. He only escaped Lithuania because he was a member of the Lithuanian parliament, had a diplomatic passport. So he came with his son. His rest of the family was killed. It's at that time, with Rommel in Egypt, that he decides to purchase land for the Panovich Yeshiva in Bnei Brak. That has a groundbreaking ceremony then. So ask why, with the Nazis just 10 days away, so he said the Jews also need a yeshiva for 10 days. In fact, in October 1942, Rommel was stopped cold at El Alamein, and it was a turning point in the war. The Nazi retreat from North Africa began. Israel was never again directly threatened, and as a result, the British declared the Haganah illegal in 1942, not having any use for it anymore. So the Haganah went underground, and at that point, 1942, joining the other underground movements. Now, it's important to note that, as always, the Jewish people were riven by internal divisions during this time as well. You recall we ended last week's lecture with Ben-Gurion's statement in August 1939, right after the white paper was enacted, that we must fight Hitler as though there were no white paper and fight the white paper as though there were no Hitler. Now, that was not completely a unanimous sentiment amongst the Jews. Now, despite the Jewish assistance to the British, support for the British, and conversely, despite the Arab support for Germany, which is something that, you know, it's hard to think about today, if only because the pattern repeats itself so often. So the Mufti tried to rile up the Arabs of the Middle East to revolt against the British. And he, in fact, did succeed in getting 6,000 Bosnian Muslims to fight together with the Germans in Central Europe. But, you know, it's a pattern. nonetheless, despite that, the British never wavered in their servile submission to Arab dictates. And in that sense, Arabs almost never pay a political price for their poor choice of allies. Just think about Arafat, for example, being on the wrong side of two Gulf Wars, not paying any price for it. Jordan being on the wrong side of the Gulf War in 1991, no political price as well. Syria, you know, back and forth, depending on what serves their interests. They pay no price because of two basic reasons, a love of oil and a hatred of Jews. And all those, both those reasons just trump whatever other concerns there are. Because of the Jewish assistance for the British, Ben-Gurion hoped at least come 1942 that there'd be a relaxation of the ban on immigration. Since already, and I saw this in my front page of the Jerusalem Post, already November 1942, they had an article about mass extermination in Europe, of death camps being established, of a 500,000 Polish Jews being killed already. It's November 1942, which is 2.5 years before the war ends, and a half year before the machinery of death is fully cranked up, which only really happened in 43, 44. Nonetheless, the British refused. Worse, they kept turning away Jewish refugees from Israel. Most famously, November 1940, the SS Patria landed with 1,700 Jews. The British decided to deport them to Mauritius. Before they could do that, the Haganah sank the Patria in Haifa Bay, so the British would be unable to deport them. The plan went awry, and before the ship sank too quickly, and 250 Jews drowned before the others were rescued. Early 1942, 770 mainly wealthy Jews and some Beitarniks fled Romania. The Romanians were awful collaborators with the Nazis. On the SS Struma, it landed in Istanbul. They were refused admission to Turkey, as well as British visas to Israel, so the Turks cast them adrift in the Adriatic, and the ship sunk as well after a mysterious explosion. The working theory today, and most of the evidence today, points to a Soviet torpedo that sunk the Struma. It was one survivor. 769 people were killed. I mean, the numbers of the Holocaust always numb. It's hard to talk about because it's just, you know, America is in an uproar because 3,100 Americans have been killed in 4 years in Iraq, 3,100. And here you had 770 killed in a moment. And you're talking in the Holocaust, 12, 13,000 a day at certain points. So the numbers are very numbing. Despite the positive attitude of Churchill to Zionism, much more so than Franklin Roosevelt, he refused to reverse the immigration policy. And of course, this called into question the effectiveness and the morality of Ben-Gurion's policy. Now, the Irgun at first supported, they agreed with Ben-Gurion. Razio, we know, mentioned, fought with the British and died. Jabotinsky himself died in New York in July 1940, and so the movement floundered for a bit. But already in 1940, one of the more outspoken members of the Irgun, Avraham Yair Stern, broke away from the Irgun and founded what was later called the Lochamei Chayrut Yisrael Lechi. He didn't give it the name. It came after he died. He perceived the British as a worse enemy than the Nazis. He said simply, the Nazis are there and the British are here, and the British are the enemy that's before us. He said the Nazis are Jew haters, but the British are enemies of the Jewish people. And he said that dying for the British is useless. So he, in fact, broke with the Irgun, with the David Raziel over this. At one point, the Lechi even negotiated with the Nazis, although the extent of their cooperation is arguable. He had a whole manifesto, 18 principles. Most of them, you know, are mother's milk to most of us. One of his principles, one, by the way, which, you know, Ben-Gurion and Brev Katznelson, a labor ideologue, had embraced in the 30s, but not overtly, and that was transfer. Stern was a proponent of transfer. He said when the Jewish state is founded, the Arabs should go to Arabia and we'll absorb all the Jews from Arab countries, and then there won't be any grounds anymore for Soros. Now, the Lehi had an interesting fundraising apparatus. We would say they were aggressive fundraisers. They robbed banks. They perpetrated dozens of assassinations, and they were reckless also, which is one reason why Begin was not always fully supportive of them. Their assassinations often killed Jews too. Stern was most wanted by the British. He was hunted down. He was killed in Tel Aviv in September 1942, after which the group took his name. Pejoratively, they were called the Stern Gang. And then it was headed afterwards by Yitzhak Shamir and Natan Yellen Mor and Yisrael Eldad, Yisrael Shaib, who I had the zchus of meeting 30 years ago. Yisrael Eldad, who really was the ideologue of the movement and drafted their ideas. Very mild-mannered but powerful individual, filled with Jewish pride. So after Stern was killed, in fact, they stopped for a short time, but then they came out again when the Haganah was banned. And now you have another person join the scene, one of the great figures of the 20th century. It's Menachem Begin. Begin was born in Brisk in 1912. His father was the secretary of the town council in Brisk and a nemesis of Reb Chaim Soloveitchik. One famous story, after Herzl died, Begin's father wanted to have a memorial service with eulogies for Herzl in the shul, and Reb Chaim banned it, and Begin's father did it anyway. That's a relationship that existed with the Rav of the town back in those days. Begin was a leading disciple of Jabotinsky, became the Rosh Beitar in Poland in 1931, was trained as a lawyer at the University of Warsaw, was always very, very legalistic, with a traditional background. He was observant his entire life. So a man put on tefillin every day and kept kosher and was observant of Shabbos, and, you know, in a traditional way, tremendous lover of Jews and lover of Israel, a very courtly gentleman, scrupulous in his private and his public dealings, which is really an anomaly today. And just a dynamic figure. If you ever heard him speak, he never, on two occasions in history, that he ever used notes when he spoke. Everything was from the heart, and he would speak for an hour, 2 hours. It made no difference. The words would just flow out of him in a poetic way. He knows my grandfather, actually, his children. Begin and my grandmother were third or fourth cousins, so the families in Europe knew each other. And my parents said there's a picture of him hanging in our house of him with my mother. He was a very, he was a gentleman. He was a very courtly individual, and he himself elicited tremendous, fierce loyalty in people. I remember growing up in Muncie, there was a fellow in the shul, in fact his daughter lives in Teaneck now, who when he would make a mishaberach on Shabbos, he would make a mishaberach for his family, and mention out of wine first, and he would always mention, that's Menachem Dov ben Zev Wolf, his father. Every Shabbos, make a mishaberach for him as well. Yeah.
Begin Museum is a great place to visit.
Okay, plug for the Begin Museum. It's absolutely true. It's a wonderful museum. Now, Begin's parents and sisters were killed by the Nazis in 1941. He fled to Vilna. He was arrested by the Soviets and sentenced to 8 years in a Siberian labor camp. Wrote a book about his experiences called White Nights, which I also recommend. With all the interrogations that he suffered under the NKVD, he never broke. And in fact, they got tired of dealing with him. That's the type of polemicist he was. That's how powerful he was in argument. When the Nazis invaded the Soviet Union, so he was freed. And he joined the Polish Free Army, went south through Iran to Israel as a member of the Polish Free Army, arrived in Israel in 1942. Now, he refused to accept any position in the Irgun because he was a member of the Polish Army. And he felt it would be a betrayal of his oath of loyalty. I mean, that's the type of stickler he was. If he would serve in another fighting force while being a member of the Polish army. So remember, the Polish nation didn't exist. There was a Polish government in exile in London, but Poland was Nazi occupied. Somehow, through diplomatic channels in December 1943, he was freed from his membership in the Polish army. And at that point, he assumed control of the Irgun. A month later, in 1944, January, he declared war on the British. Now, Begin set about to weaken Britain's hold on Israel by sapping its spirit. and by making them feel that the losses in holding the land outweighed the gains. In this he was very successful. Paul Johnson, historian, writes in his History of the Jewish People that it was Begin who forced the British out, while it was Ben-Gurion who founded the Jewish state. And it's a very pithy but accurate way to say it. One without the other would not have been successful. But Ben-Gurion was successful in laying the foundation of the state, whereas it's Begin who really drove the British out. And it's controversial. Of course, it's led to the accusations that Begin was a terrorist. Johnson himself writes that this was a Jewish contribution to the world, what he calls the scientific use of terror to break the will of liberal rulers. It's a little overstated because, especially considering that the British weren't exactly liberal rulers in the land of Israel, and they were at least partly, if not greatly, responsible for the deaths of millions of Jews. So it's hard to call them liberal rulers, but there's a better definition. You know, the mantra of the 90s was one man's freedom fighters, another man's terrorist. But I just read recently someone came up, a legal scholar, with a definition, a three-pronged definition of the difference between a terrorist and a freedom fighter. The two which are most apposite are that a freedom fighter does not engage in any attacks on civilians, and a freedom fighter is fighting for freedom, meaning the establishment of democracy. In that sense, according to this, Begin was the ultimate freedom fighter. And just contrast that with all the Arab terrorists, who in fact are quite illiberal in both their tactics and their goals. Zionist rescue efforts during the Holocaust. There's not much to speak of. They were limited, for sure, in what they could do. But sad to say, their focus was not on saving Jews, but on building statehood. In 1942, they adopted what was called the Biltmore Program, after the hotel which was ratified, that called for open immigration and the establishment of a Jewish commonwealth, but it fell on deaf ears. Now, cooperation with the British made some sense, but it didn't help. And the Zionists also actively opposed some efforts that were made. One in particular became a thorn in their side. It was a gentleman named Hillel Cook, Rav Cook's nephew, who in America adopted the alias Peter Bergson. He was a revisionist Zionist, the follower of Jabotinsky. He became very active, very provocative in America with advertisements and rallies and speeches trying to get the Jewish community aroused. He was opposed by the establishment, who maintained that he was unauthorized and therefore tried to tell the government officials not to deal with him. Nonetheless, he was extremely active and successful in a number of things. He, together with the Igudas Rabbonim, organized the March on Washington, the Rabbi's March on Washington, on the day before Erev Yom HaKippur in 1943. Several hundred rabbis came, hoping to see Franklin Roosevelt. He refused to see them. They did succeed in getting the War Refugee Board set up, which eventually saved 100,000 Jewish lives, so that was a success. I mentioned Agav Urcha. In 1995, I was part of the Second Rabbi's March on Washington to oppose Oslo and to stop American government aid to the Palestinian Authority. And again, we were partially successful as well, but what most impressed me is that four elderly rabbis came in 1995 to our rally. I was one of the spokesmen at the group. Four of the rabbis who were there in 1943, young men, now 50 years later, older men came down to protest again. So another famous incident, which we'll get back to next week, the Kastner controversy. In 1944, Adolf Eichmann, Yamach Shmo V'Zichro, made an offer to Jewish representatives in Hungary, among them Rav Michal Ber Weissmandl, one of the great figures of Jewish rescue during the Holocaust, and Joel Brand, that he would sell Jews for trucks if they needed supplies to take to fight the Soviets. And the plan, Eichmann's suggestion, ultimately became if the Jews would get 10,000 trucks, they would give them 1 million Jews in return, 100,000 Jews per truck. I'm sorry, it was 10,000 Jews per truck. And Rudolf Brand brought the offer to Rudolf Kastner. Kastner was the head of the Judenrat in Budapest, as well as the head of the Zionist organization in Budapest. Very well connected, too well connected. The Nazis guaranteed or gave their word they would use the trucks only against the Russians, not against the British or the Americans, so as to smooth the deal. As a good faith gesture, Eichmann stopped temporarily the deportations of Hungarian Jews to Auschwitz, and Kastner himself was allowed to choose. It became 1,685 people who would ride a freedom train, what was called a VIP train, from Hungary to Switzerland. He chose mainly his family and Zionists. Only non-Zionist he chose was the Satmar Rebbe, Rabbi Yoel Teitelbaum, strange as it sounds. The legend that Kastner had a dream that if he let the Rebbe accompany the train, it would make it safely to Switzerland. The train, in fact, was diverted to Bergen-Belsen, where it stayed for 3 or 4 months, and then it eventually did go to Bergen-Belsen, and it did go to Switzerland, and they made it to safety. Agav Urcha, when I was young and aggressive, so the Israel Day Parade, I would always scream against the Natura Karta there. And one of the things I once yelled at them was that the Zionists saved the Satmar Rebbe. And the police had to intervene. They told me to go to the other side of the street, because there's nothing more provocative to the Satmar than to tell them that the Rebbe's existence is due to the Zionists. So then how can you be against them? But nonetheless, it's true. The problem is, of course, the Jewish agency never agreed to the plan. They never agreed to the plan. Brand was arrested by the British and imprisoned in Egypt. His family had been taken hostage by Eichmann. They were then all killed, and the fate of Hungarian Jewry was sealed. Keep in mind, Hungarian Jewry was the last large contingent of Jews to suffer the fate of the Holocaust. Kastner himself would be accused of collaboration and indirect participation with the murder of Jews. In a famous libel suit in the 1950s in Israel, the very first Holocaust trial, that we'll get to next week, but the betrayal of the Zionists became a cliche. Ben Hecht wrote a best-selling book, Perfidy, about this whole incident, and this sense of betrayal is still extant. Now, illegal immigration continued during the war, but still the Zionists sought only Zionists, even during the Holocaust. Moshe Sharet said, we can't have unrestricted immigration. We have no control over who's coming. And he was the political director of the Jewish agency then, later to be foreign minister and prime minister. He said, take care to bring only, I quote, desirable human material. Bring the good, not the rabble. That is, do the exact opposite of what the revisions were doing. They were grabbing everybody. Later in 1944, the Jewish agency felt they had a need to act, to prove that they had done something, so they dispatched paratroopers to Hungary through the Royal Air Force to set up an underground there, but they were never told what to do. And most of them were arrested, some were executed, famously Chana Senesh, but they accomplished very little except create the legend that they wanted to have created, that they were in fact actively involved in the saving of Jews. Part of the problem of history always is that the victors write the story. And so the legends grow around whatever political goal the victors always want to establish. Meanwhile, in the land of Israel, the war against the British continued. The British relented in 1944 and allowed the Haganah to reopen, and they formed the Jewish Brigade, which fought in Italy and elsewhere. Begin, though, began attacks on British military installations in 1944, but all of this paled before the November 6, 1944 assassination of Lord Moyne, who was the British Minister of State in the Middle East, by the Lehi. The British went ballistic, literally. Jews were killed on the streets. They cracked down, and worse, the Haganah joined the British in what became known infamously in Israel as the Saison, the hunting season. The British and the Haganah hunted down members of the Irgun and the Etzel, arresting them in the hundreds and turning them over to the British. The bitter taste from the Saison also lingers until today. Now, the Haganah had two aims, to curry favor with the British and to weaken the role of the other groups for domestic political benefit, and that was another pattern. The Haganah never hesitated to attack or to betray or to kill Jews when it suited their purposes. At this point, Begin escaped. He went underground. He never reappeared until May 15, 1948, had a number of aliases. One of them was as Rabbi Yisrael Sassover, who just sat and learned the whole day. People knew of his existence. He grew a beard, and he looked the part. Having grown up in a traditional environment, he knew exactly what to do and how to look. Once he came close to being caught, but he hid in a cupboard, and they weren't able to find him. And for days, he would stay in a cupboard and just listen to BBC. He said once that's how he learned English, listening to BBC in his cupboard. If you want to rile up an old revisionist today, just mention the Cezanne and see the reaction. The war ended May 8, 1945, and the Jews were greeted with shock and horror when they realized the extent of the losses and that Jewish statehood was no closer. The sympathetic Churchill, one of the great men of the century also, won the war for the British, was thanked by the British for being voted out of office just a month after the war ended in June, replaced by Clement Attlee. Attlee was no sympathizer of Jews. In fact, when they said that the refugees should be allowed admission to Israel, he said, no, there are many refugees of the war. If the Jews will push to the front of the queue, they'll only arouse hostility in people. What hostility they could arouse after 6 million already dead is hard to imagine. His foreign minister was a notorious Jew-hater, Ernest Bevin, who refused to allow any of the survivors to come to Israel. He's going to establish all the displaced persons camps in Egypt. When Truman demanded, President Truman, of course, succeeded Roosevelt in April when he died, Truman demanded in November 1945 that 100,000 Jews be allowed to enter Israel immediately. Bevin said that's only because he doesn't want them in New York. He wants them in Israel. With that, the Haganah changed its tune again, and in November began cooperating with the other underground movements. Begin had a nice analysis of the division of responsibility. The Lehi would commit individual acts of terror, the Etzel sporadic military operations, and the Haganah would be the final weight in the decisive war, since they were the most numerous and the well-armed. And there were joint missions, but it was short-lived. Major attacks became very famous. October 10, 1945, the Haganah attacked the detention camp at Atlit, liberated 200 illegal immigrants. A few weeks later, November 1st, was called the Night of the Railroads. They blew up all the railroads across Israel, which destroyed the British transport system. June 17, 1946, 10 of the 11 bridges that linked Israel to surrounding countries were blown up. This after the British rejected the findings of the Anglo-American Commission that said 100,000 Jews should be allowed to enter. With the blowing up of the bridges, the British acted June 29, 1946, known as Black Shabbos, Shabbat HaShachor. The British arrested all the leaders of the Zionist movement. Ben-Gurion escaped. He was in America at the time. They scoured the land for illegal arms and illegal soldiers. 2,700 Jews were arrested, sent to Gaza. If you've been to this Moshav near Rehovot to see the underground bullet factory, so you know why the British were not able to find it. It was underneath a bakery and a laundry. But they went settlement to settlement, rounding up fighters and arms. The Jewish agency declared a general strike and a fast. But the main response came 3 weeks later, July 22, 1946, when the Etzel blew up the King David Hotel. Now, bear in mind, it wasn't the tourist attraction. It was the headquarters for the British civilian and military administration. They'd taken over two-thirds of the hotel. The British haughtily ignored the warning that was called in. The head of the mandate said, in response to the secretary brought in the warning, that we don't take orders from Jews. They were told to evacuate. We give orders to Jews. 91 people were killed, including 17 Jews. The Haganah had approved the operation. Then they retracted their approval. Begin went ahead anyway, and they pretended to be aghast at what happened. The next day issued a statement expressing horror at the dastardly crime, which of course they had been in on the planning, all in order to blacken the name of the Etzel. General Barker, who was the British military commander, ordered a boycott of Jewish stores, saying famously, hit them in the pocketbook. That's all this race cares about. But the British toll was great in loss of life and treasure. Illegal immigration continued, but most were caught and sent to Cyprus. The British put almost their entire Mediterranean fleet to work blocking Jewish immigration. By 1947, it was all-out war. The British lived in fear. No British military base or installation was safe except on Shabbos. Strange as it sounds, Begin writes in his book, The Revolt, he insisted the Irgun be Shomer Shabbos. They attacked no one on Shabbos, so the British soldiers knew they could rest on Shabbos. In March of 47, martial law and curfew were declared, and then on and off sporadically. Akko prison was liberated. In April, 120 Jews were freed, along with more Arabs who escaped as well, but such as it is. The British, in response, hanged four members of the Etzel for a variety of crimes, well known as Dov Gruner, all buried in Tzfat. The Etzel, Begin had warned that if they're hanged, the Etzel would hang British soldiers as well. Begin had warned they would hang British soldiers as well. V'chein hoyo, just 2 days later, they captured two British sergeants at random and hanged them outside of Netanya, which provoked riots in England against the Jews, and a riot in Tel Aviv of British soldiers against Jewish stores as well. In July of 47, the famous ship, the Exodus, came with 4,500 refugees. They were rejected, sent back to France, and worst of all, sent back to Germany, to Hamburg. Paul Newman was on that ship, I think. The world was horrified, mainly because it was all filmed. The first power, it wasn't television, but it was the movie tone. It was all filmed, the arrival in Haifa and in France and in Hamburg, and it made a tremendous impact on people. By then, an exasperated Britain had turned to the UN for guidance, hoping that they couldn't muster a two-thirds majority to do anything, but nonetheless looking for guidance. UN formed a commission, the first of several thousand commissions on Palestine, exists until today. Until today, there's what's known as the Standing Committee on Palestine that meets every year and has anti-Israel resolutions. UN Special Commission on Palestine, UNSCOP, traveled the land. They recommended partition. November 29, 1947, the UN votes 33-13 to approve the partition of the land into two states, a Jewish state and an Arab state. The 13 were mainly Arab. There were also 10 abstentions, and that was British and the allies of the British. The partition of the land was recommended. The Jewish state was minuscule. If you turn to page 5, you see the Palestine Mandate. Western Eretz Yisrael to the west of the Jordan River. If you turn to the next page, page 7, you see the partition plan, which gave Israel the eastern part of the Galil, the coastal plain, running from slightly north of Haifa to slightly south of Yafo, excluding Yafo, and most of the barren Negev, Yerushalayim, to be an international city. There were settlements in the Negev, in Gaza, in Yudan Shamron. Nonetheless, they were put on the chopping block. The mandate would end, the British mandate, May 15th, 1948. The Soviets surprised the world. They voted in favor, along with the Soviet bloc, to partition the land. A person became later very famous to us in America. Andrei Gromyko was the deputy foreign minister at the time, gave a very powerful speech, textbook Zionism, about why the Jews deserve their own state. The Soviet ambassador to the UN, when the vote came, lifted a glass of champagne to toast the new Jewish state. What happened to Stalin? So the Soviets were a bit, you know, astute politicians. They wanted the British out of the Middle East, and the Americans were tied up elsewhere. They saw the potential for a socialist outpost in the Middle East, because that was the dominant movement in Israel, not to mention Israel had a flourishing Communist Party, led by Mayor Vilna, that was pro-Soviet. And they saw the Americans vacillating. Most of the Jewish world rejoiced, not everyone. The old binationalists, Judah Magnus, Martin Buber, now joined by Yeshayahu Leibovich, were against it. Hannah Arendt wrote an article, she's a writer, that this will lead to endless war if there's a Jewish state. And that was also the opinion of the Brisker Rav, or Belville Soloveitchik, Chaim's son, who had come to Israel from Lithuania in 1940, he said the same thing, there'll be endless war, and in fact they were correct. That doesn't mean that they were wrong declaring a state, but in fact they were correct. Arabs, as we know, rejected it vehemently, and the next day launched a brutal terrorist war that lasted from November 29, 1947, the day of the resolution, until independence. In those 6 months, more than 1,200 Jews were killed. Every inch of the land was contested. Yerushalayim, which was to be an international city, saw heavy and constant fighting, and the British spent the last few months disarming and fighting the Jews and strengthening the Arabs. Now, the Americans had a role as well. I wrote my thesis as a senior in college on America's role in the Middle East. Fair to say, had FDR lived, there would have been no Israel. FDR cut a deal with Ibn Saud at Yalta not to allow the Jews to have a Jewish state. You could argue both ways, but Truman was not privy to that agreement and didn't feel bound by it once he found out about it. Truman was no lover of Jews, but he was a decent person and had a very steady moral compass. So no doubt American diplomacy was critical in securing the two-thirds vote in the UN General Assembly and then not wavering in the face of pressure. But the toll of blood, and you're talking thousands killed, if after the partition resolution, sapped Truman's faith in the viability of a Jewish state, and he himself started to weaken. And in March 1948, he gave a hint that he was going to favor a trusteeship and not statehood. The State Department was always against a Jewish state. General Marshall was dead set against it. This sparked the famous visit of Truman's business partner, Eddie Jacobson, in March 1948 to the White House. Now, there's a lot of mythology about this also. Eddie Jacobson was not Truman's best friend, wasn't even his friend. Truman really didn't care much for Jews. He was his business partner. In independence, before and after World War I, they had a haberdashery that went bankrupt. But what impressed Truman most about Jacobson was that together they paid off every creditor. They got new jobs and they paid off everyone. So he saw Jacobson as an honorable person. American Zionists never impressed Truman that much. He found them to be disrespectful and mean. Read a nice account of this in McCullough's biography of Truman. In any event, Jacobson came and he had open access to the White House. And he came on condition he not speak about Zionism at all. Truman didn't want to hear about it, but Jacobson didn't care, and he raised the issue. Truman exploded that he has no use for the Zionists and the way the Jews are treating them. And Jacobson said these words, and I read now, because at this point Truman had already decided to favor the trusteeship. He said to him, "Harry, all your life you've had a hero." There was a bust of Andrew Jackson in the Oval Office that was Truman's hero. "I too have a hero, a man I never met, but who is, I think, the greatest Jew who ever lived. I forgive the hyperbole. I'm talking about Chaim Weizmann. He's a very sick man, almost broken in health, but he traveled 1,000 miles just to see you." Weizmann at the time was the figurehead. He was the president of the Zionist organization. He had really no power, but he was a symbol. "He came this way to see you and plead the cause of my people. Now you refuse to see him just because you are insulted by some of our American Jewish leaders. Even though you know that Weizmann had absolutely nothing to do with these insults and would be the last man to be party to them. It doesn't sound like you, Harry, because I thought you could take this stuff they have been handing out." Truman, as McCullough writes, turned in his chair, looked out the window of the Oval Office, sat there for what Jacobson said was an eternity, and then turned to him and said, "You'll forgive, I'll clean it up. You win, you bald-headed SOB. I will see him." And in fact, Weizmann came to the White House 3 days later, and Truman gave him his word that he would support a Jewish state. 2 days after that, the American ambassador in the UN nonetheless announced that America had changed its policy and would now support a trusteeship. Truman was aghast because he felt that Weizmann would think he was a liar, and he repudiated his own UN ambassador and State Department. And thereafter, despite whatever pressure there was, he continued. 1948, it was an election year. Truman was an accidental president, of course. He was trailing badly in the polls. The opponents always claimed that he did this for the Jewish vote. Only people who think that Jewish votes have any influence are Jews and Jew haters. The fact is, supporting Israel probably cost him more votes than it gained him. The most reasonable explanation of why Truman did what he did is because of sympathy and morality and a sense of destiny. Rav Herzog would later meet Truman and say to him, "I want to shake the hand of the man who was put into his mother's womb to establish again the Jewish state." And Truman burst into tears. V'gam Charvona zachur latov, Clark Clifford and David Niles were extremely helpful, and they kept nudging Truman this direction. Those who opposed because of the traditional reason, they didn't care for Jews, Arab oil, the need for Arab political support. They feared a massacre of Jews in the land of Israel once the British army left. They felt they'd have to send 100,000 American troops to defend them. Czechoslovakia had just fallen to the Soviets, and Italy and France seemed to be heading in a communist direction. So they felt it was best to lie low. Nonetheless, Truman after that did not waver at all. After partition, the Arab fury broke out. Azam Pasha, the head of the Arab League, said, "This will be a war of extermination and a momentous massacre, which will be spoken of like the Mongolian massacres and the Crusades." And he thought this was a soundbite that would win favor in the West. In fact, it didn't, but it was sadly true. That was their goal. Shootings, bombings, attacks on settlements. The Jewish agency right away had to choose between defending the assigned territory, that small territory from the partition plan, or essentially nullifying the agreement and seizing what they could. In fact, they did both. The terror continued. The office of the Jerusalem Post, the Palestine Post, was blown up. Rehov Yehuda was blown up. Dozens were killed. The Jewish agency building itself was blown up. Convoys were attacked. There was a war before the war. So the War of Independence started in November of 47, not in May of 48. January 1948, the Arab Liberation Army is formed. Fazi al-Kawkji fights in the north. Tirat Zvi fights him off. Convoys to Gush Etzion are attacked in January from an Arab village called Surif, which as recently as 2 weeks ago stoned Jewish cars on the road to coming from Yerushalayim to the Gush. 35 Jews were massacred, the famous Nativ HaLamed Hay. Their bodies were carved up, which became an Arab custom as well. Fighting in Tel Aviv and Yafo throughout the land as the British planned their withdrawal in stages. As they withdrew, the Haganah moved in. Operation Nachshon started in April with new arms, secretly delivered from Czechoslovakia. Most threatened was Yerushalayim because it was isolated, surrounded by Arabs, and not given to Jews. It was a siege against the city. Operation Nachshon sought a roof of the convoys. Those are the convoys we see on the road to Yerushalayim. For a long time, Yerushalayim suffered under very strict rationing of food and fuel, no electricity constantly, no running water. The convoys were crucial. April 10th, the village of Castel, the high point, the sign of the Harel Brigade when you start the descent before the ascent to Yerushalayim, that was captured after heavy fighting. The Arab commander, Abd al-Qadr al-Husseini, the Mufti's nephew, was killed. The road was temporarily open, but then again closed. In this same context, the Arab village of Deir Yassin was also attacked on April 9th by a combined force of the Etzel and the Lehi. They announced their arrival. Arabs started firing, some of them in women's clothing. When the shooting ended, a third of the attacking force were casualties, but more than 200 Arabs were killed. Deir Yassin, by the way, is very close to where Harnof is today, if you really want to know. There were three consequences. One, Ben-Gurion castigated the Irgun for their violence. Again, the same pattern. Secondly, 4 days later, the Arabs attacked a medical convoy from Hadassah, leaving Eretz Ofim. 77 doctors and nurses were murdered in cold blood. And thirdly, the Arabs publicized the loss. The Arabs publicized what they held was the massacre, and they began fleeing in great numbers. Meanwhile, with the road open, 250 trucks with supplies entered Yerushalayim on Shabbos, April 17th, and permission was given to unload the trucks because of Pikuach Nefesh. In truth, the Arabs had started fleeing before this. You all remember Edward Said, a professor at Columbia, the hater of Jews. His family left in November already, went to Cairo because they didn't want to be involved in the fighting. They left the old city. There's a great controversy again until today. Arabs fled because, in order of relevance, they feared being killed in the fighting. They were told by Arab leaders to leave. One famous statement an Arab made in 1954 to a Jordanian newspaper, they told us to get out so they can get in. But we got out and they didn't get in. During the war itself, Arabs were in fact expelled from Ramla, Lod. Those towns were to be Arab, but they were important to secure the road between Tel Aviv and Yerushalayim. And also the Mufti himself ordered Arabs not to remain under Jewish rule as a violation of some Islamic law. But most left for the first two reasons. They were afraid to be killed, and they were told by the Arabs to leave. In retrospect, Deir Yassin hurt the Etzel politically, but it greatly benefited Israel because the Arabs inflated what had happened in order to generate sympathy. Instead, they generated mass panic and hysteria. The law of unintended consequences again. As the pre-war war continued, later in April, Operation Yiftach, Tveria was captured, the Arabs fled. Tzfat was captured, the Arabs fled. Famous story, we were at the monument a few years ago. The creative of Davidka, which is a mortar that didn't accomplish much, but made a lot of noise. And in Tzfat, when they fired the Davidka, it started to rain, and the Arabs thought it was an atomic bomb. And they also fled Tzfat. In Haifa, the Arabs fled despite pleas from the Jews to stay. Yaffa was captured along with another 100 Arab villages. To Arabs who protest the injustice, and protest they do, the simple answer is they fought and they lost. Had they won, no Jew would have remained alive, and we wouldn't be having this discussion today. Now, there were losses also, especially Gush Etzion, which finally fell after heavy fighting on Friday, May 14th. Simply, Ben-Gurion refused to send further reinforcements to what he felt was a lost cause. Most were massacred. Survivors were taken prisoner by the Jordanian Legion. Now, throughout the spring, there was tremendous uncertainty what would happen when the British left. Statehood, trusteeship, maybe they find an excuse to stay, a provisional government without a formal declaration of statehood, all these things were discussed. Many voices, many opinions. One problem of statehood, a state has to have boundaries. What are the boundaries? Well, they didn't want the boundaries of the partition plan anymore because they'd conquered more territory already. The Briskarov, among others, pleaded for no declaration, again, be permanent war, perhaps destruction of the entire Yishuv. The American State Department, like the British again, were vehemently against statehood. Ben-Gurion insisted on statehood. He won a small majority for statehood in the National Council. They decided not to declare formal boundaries, which Ad Hayom don't exist, and to name the new state Israel, you know. But the first proposal was to name it Zion, which was rejected. May 14, 1948, Ben-Gurion reads the Declaration of Independence in Tel Aviv. Some 6 hours before the mandate would end at midnight, that night was Shabbat, it's on Friday. So Heyyar, independence was to be Vaviyar, but it was really Heyyar because of Shabbos. The Megillat Atzmaut spoke about the Jewish people's return to the land after exile, and it echoed the Balfour Declaration in reaching out to the local and surrounding Arabs. There was no religious reference, again, presaging future arguments, except finally they agreed to have the final paragraph begin, Mitoch bitachon betzur Yisrael, with faith in the rock of Israel. The Mapam was apoplectic, Tzur Yisrael, Kum of Ezras Yisrael, and Ben-Gurion said, leave it alone, so to you it's a rock, to them it's God, Tzur Yisrael. Rabbi Yehuda Leib Fishman Maimon, the head of Mizrahi, stood up and said, Shechayon b'shem u'malchus, and the state was declared. Within 10 minutes, the Americans de facto recognized the state. Several hours later, the Soviets de jure recognized the state, a higher level of recognition, went into effect Shabbos at midnight. Begin's first act, Ben-Gurion's first act, abolishing the 1939 white paper and opening the land of Israel to all Jewish immigration. The special UN assembly session to discuss trusteeship was adjourned Friday, May 14th, until September, and never met again. Begin came out of hiding on Sunday, and on Sunday spoke on the radio with tremendous emotion. Shabbos morning, May 15th, Tel Aviv was bombed, and the combined but not unified forces of 7 countries descended on the nascent Jewish state, and the invasion began. More on that next time. but how the war would be conducted and how it would end and how the foundation of the Jewish state would be laid, that would happen in the next few years and would dictate the agenda for the next 60 years. But for the first time since the Churban Beis HaMikdash, Jewish sovereignty had returned to part of the land of Israel. I thank you very much. That was Rabbi Huda Leib Fishman Maimon. Here. That was in June. He stopped in May.